Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead, and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Very optimistic. Very optimistic.
Well, that is a good frame of mind for not only a speculist blogger, but a Fast Forward Radio host, I must say. That's kind of a job requirement, really, around here, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're just always a bummer or a downer, you're just not going to be invited on that often to either write or be on the program. So it seems that our guests tend to be optimists as well. So, yeah, exactly.
It's true, by and large.
Yep.
We do trade in the occasional bleak scenario. The 80-20 rule means that a fifth of the time, theoretically, we talk about the negative stuff. We probably don't do it nearly that often, but we do give credence to the downside of scenarios. But we spend a lot more time talking about the upside because one, it's more fun, and two, it does us more good against most of the potential bad outcomes to be focusing on good outcomes than it does to worry about bad outcomes. But that's not our argument for tonight. We're going to be talking about something else tonight. although it's always fun to get into that one. How do you fix all the bad stuff by focusing on the good stuff? That's one of our kind of shocking outside the box ideas here at Fast Forward Radio. And we're going to look at how.
I lost you, Phil. Do you hear me? Okay. Well, there's our glitch.
Optimism has on our health, and I want to talk a little bit about what current medical research shows there, and then maybe we can just talk a little bit generally about what reasons there are to be optimistic about our health, about our future as regards healthy lifestyles and living longer and overcoming significant health problems that we've faced over the years. So that's kind of the major thing we'll be getting into tonight. If time permits, we've got probably a few other topics to get into as well. But before we jump into that, we kind of skipped, how's it going?
Pretty good. I hope that I don't have a coughing thing going on. Maybe I'm not being optimistic enough. Maybe if I were more optimistic about beating this cough, I would have had it behind me by now. So, anyway, I'm going to endeavor to do that.
Possibly.
Yeah. So
that's entirely possible. Well, I was just mentioning before the show started that I've got seasonal allergies going on here. The autumn stuff is really getting to me, so my voice is cracking a bit too. But we are going to let our smiles be our umbrella here today. This evening.
We're going to soldier on and demonstrate through our action and our carrying on how to be optimistic in adverse times and adverse conditions.
Adverse times. That's right. We've got a cough and hoarseness that we're dealing with. Lord, the humanity, huh? Okay, so.
Oh, the humanity. Okay, yeah.
So we'll go ahead and jump into it. I got interested in this topic. I did that talk for Mensa a couple of weeks ago. I believe I've mentioned a couple of times now. And some subsequent discussions I've had with one of my friends who was there is just around optimism and why it's so important. I think that you know, as a value, it's something that that we push out on this program. It's something certainly that we've talked a lot about on The Speculist. And I got to thinking about what is the connection between health and optimism, if there is one, if there's one that that medical research has demonstrated. So I thought, well, I'm gonna, you know, I'll look this up. So I went to Wolfram Alpha and I did a couple searches there, and there wasn't an awful lot. And so I thought, well, I'll just do a Google search for, you know, links between health and optimism. And that took me over to PubMed, which is that's a online database. It's the U.S. National Library of Medicine and the National Institutes of Health put this out, and it's the Medline database. So this is like, I think doctors use this database to access research. So generally speaking, if there's something interesting going on in the field of health, you can find published material on the subject using PubMed. It's a great free resource. Now, it'll find you the articles. Some of them are online for you to read for free, and some of them require a subscription. You have to pay for them. But you can get abstracts of almost anything online. And I thought, well, I can probably figure a little bit out about this just by reading abstracts. You know, there's a certain amount you can glean just by reading titles, actually, of papers. And with some of these medical journal articles, the title is about the last thing I read that I understand, right? You know, it's like as soon as you, yeah, you know, as soon as you jump into the abstract, you're like, okay, you've lost me. Although some of them, and this is kind of interesting too, some of them you can read and the entire thing makes sense, even though they're talking sometimes in very dense jargon and very heavy medicalese. You can work your way through it. It's something about, I don't know, difference in writing style. So I get on PubMed, and after I had done some initial research, I got interested in just how many articles are online there. I still don't know. If anyone knows and they want to pop that up in the chat room, that would be great. I've looked on Wikipedia, and I didn't see it there. Here we go. 12.1 million articles are listed with their abstracts, and 3.4 – now it jumps out in front of me as soon as I say I couldn't find it. 3.4 million articles are available full text for free. So this is a huge resource of data. And about 500,000 new journal articles are added to PubMed every year. So this is a terrific resource. And if you're interested in doing your own independent scholarly work in, you know, bioscience or medical science, great place to start. In fact, probably a great place to do a lot of your background research in this kind of stuff. So 12.1 million articles. I went through and I did a like keyword search on the word health is what I did, and it spit back like 2 million. So I said, okay, so I know there's at least 2 million articles. So now we know there's 12 million articles in there. Okay, so I did a keyword search on optimism. Now, this is not fair, Stephen, but, you know, I always love putting you on the spot with these kinds of things. Out of 12 million articles, how many do you think turned up positive in my keyword search for optimism?
Okay, the question is whether of those 12 million, how many thought that
just have the word optimism in them? Yeah.
Oh. You know, a whole lot. I'd say half of them.
Oh no, you're way off.
Okay.
Well, for one thing, I was only finding 2 million articles on there, but I got about 4,500 that had the word optimism in them.
Okay. So, I'm sorry. I may have misunderstood your question. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah. So, you know, six million articles, about 4,500 had the word optimism in it. That would have been pretty cool if there were 6 million. But I might have been so intimidated that I wouldn't even have gone on at that point. I'd been like, okay, I'm beaten. So I found 4,500 articles that at least use the word, and I'm like, well, what are they saying? You know, or I'm sorry, it's not just that it has it in it. I guess that it was indexed as a keyword for that, right? That's the
okay.
That's,
okay.
Yeah.
That's the,
that,
yeah.
I should make that distinction, right?
Well, that means that it actually has something to do with optimism. The paper,
yeah, somehow
know.
Or other, optimism is key to this piece of research. That's right.
Yeah. Okay. That's that's an impressive number, actually.
Yeah, 4,500. And I said, okay, well, that's interesting. I'm going to start reading these abstracts and see what I can make of that. And I decided that And, you know, I don't know anything about much about statistics or representative samples or anything like that. What do you think? What once again, just this is pure speculation on your part. What would be the – if there's 4,500 of them, how many do you have to read before you've got kind of a good feel for what it's like generally, do you think?
I don't know, Phil. You weighed through about 20, 30, 40? What did you do?
I read 100 of them. Okay, so
okay.
Good. Right. I feel like I did my work then. So I read the first 100 abstracts with the keyword optimism in PubMed. This is you do what you like on Saturday night. I'll do what I like on Saturday night. and here's what I came up with.
Bill.
Yeah, that's right. So out of 100 articles, there were articles that made a link between optimism and positive health outcomes out of 100, 38. 38 that just flat out said either we've got research that shows it or we're doing research that assumes it. For example, in a lot of mental health type studies, they take it pretty much as a given that your optimism level reduces your stress or it's beneficial against depression. It could be that there's earlier research that actually, you know, showed that, but a lot of these later studies, they're just assuming that now. They're just saying, well, since we know, you know, it's like axiomatic to some mental health studies that optimism is positive. But I counted all those because those all show a link between optimism and positive health outcomes. So that's interesting, and it was by far and away that's the largest set out of those first 100 of what the word optimism is doing in those stories. Now, linking to negative outcomes for health, would you care to take a guess? How many out of 100?
Oh, very few. What, maybe 5, 10, what?
Four, actually. Yeah, there were four.
Okay.
That linked to negative health outcomes. And it was generally things like, the ones I saw were things like people who continue to smoke because they were unduly optimistic about what their life expectancy was by continuing to smoke. So there are definitely circumstances and situations where being optimistic is not going to help your health, and it's going to be detrimental to your health. But by a factor of about 10 to 1, the link to positive health outcomes outnumbered the link to negative health outcomes. Then there was linking to what I'm just going to call neutral outcomes. They had to do more with it was more like how the optimism of the researcher impacts the parents or something like it. It was something other than saying this optimism of the patient has this impact on the patient. So I was like, okay, I pulled all those up. There was like 7 out of 100 were like that. Also, optimism is a technical term inside the field of statistics. And in 5 out of 100 studies, that's what it meant when you saw the word optimism. There were 14 out of 100 where I just couldn't quite figure out what they were saying, so I called that other. I'm like, I see the word optimism, and I don't know what they mean, so we'll have to get another authority to look at that. And then 2 other categories, and the next biggest and a much smaller category. The next biggest after linking optimism to positive health outcomes was referring to not the optimism of the patient, but referring to optimism of researchers and the medical community generally. So
It
would be a statement of, the story, you know, the article is about a new or a developing treatment for thyroid cancer, right? And the optimism referenced is, optimism that the researchers have that this is actually going to really move the field along well. Okay, so 27 out of 100 was actually talking about this research is going well and it's pushing us in a good direction. And the only other category I've mentioned every other category was disputing the optimism of the medical community, and that was when they were saying there's too much optimism about this thyroid cancer treatment, whatever it might be, and those were about 5 out of 100. So all that is to say, 38 plus 27, what is that math-wise, 65?
Yep.
Is that right? 65 out of 100 of those stories go directly to either linking optimism to positive health outcomes, or to showing why there's good reason for the medical community to be optimistic about certain lines of research. So I think it's cool that we're talking about both of these sides of the coin tonight, because those were actually the two big categories that that showed up there. Now, one thing I should point out before we get any further with this is that there is a difference between linking to positive health outcomes and absolute cause and effect, right? So you don't want to you don't want to say that this proves that if you're optimistic, you're healthier, because that's not exactly what's being shown here. In a lot of these studies, the terminology they use is it's a predictor. So they'll look at people recovering from open heart surgery, or they'll look at people who have undergone a certain type of chemotherapy, and optimism is actually a predictor of survival in a number of these studies. That is to say that whether you live or die, and whether you're optimistic or not, are like one-to-one associated in many cases. Does that mean that the optimism is what's saving you, or does it mean that people who are going to live tend to be more optimistic? You know what I mean? It's like, well, maybe they were the healthier ones, right? They were going to live anyway, so of course they would be somewhat more optimistic. Now, these studies try very hard to eliminate those various biases, but I don't think they can do it to the extent that you can say one-to-one absolutely this causes that. But suppose for a moment, I mean, you know, let's say it's in any given situation, it's half and half, right? Half of it is just that the person who lives longer tends to be more optimistic, and half of it is that the person who tends to be more optimistic lives longer, right?
Okay.
I'll still go with the let's be more optimistic then, right? I mean, even if it's 80-20, right? Even if it's 90-10 in favor of healthy people are more optimistic, and only 10% of the time is it that optimistic people tend to be healthier, you know, that's still worth doing, it seems to me.
What was the quote from Julius Caesar? The coward dies a thousand deaths. The brave man dies but once. I think you can say the same thing. I think you can say the same thing about optimists versus pessimists. You know, if a person who's truly pessimistic is dwelling on death, they're always down. And and the optimist, you know, he ends up at some point just as dead as the pessimist, right? Does that mean optimism doesn't work? Absolutely not. It doesn't mean that optimism doesn't work. The optimist enjoyed his life, you know. So,
exactly. Yeah. There's something to be said for just net happiness out of a given span of 75 years. I haven't even looked into the research linking optimism with happiness, but you've got to expect that it's there. And some of these studies come darn close to that. Some of them talk about they talk about optimism and anxiety, or they talk about negative health outcomes. And I was pretty generous. Okay, so for example, if the study mentioned optimism, but it was really showing that hostility leads to negative health outcomes, I went ahead and counted that as one that's showing that optimism makes you healthier, okay? Because this is not pure science. This is me just trying to classify some things for our understanding. And I'm not going to attempt to publish my findings on PubMed. I'm talking about it on Fast Forward Radio. So I think I'm allowed to do that. The other thing I wanted to say about this is there was at least one out of that 100 study that I found that was a meta-analysis. And let me just – I'll just share a little bit of the abstract from that one, because that was scientists doing what – in a focused way, what I'm doing in a very broad, general, sloppy way here, which was that they went through the research and tried to make sense of it. They went through all the optimism research to say, you know, what is this showing us? And here's what they're – the study was called Optimism and Physical Health, a Meta-Analytic Review. And it says the findings from 83 studies with 108 effect sizes were included in the analysis using random effect models. I think somewhere at least, yeah. Subsidiary analyses were also conducted, grouping studies into those that focused solely on mortality, survival, cardiovascular outcomes, physiological markers, including immune function, immune function only, cancer outcomes, outcomes related to pregnancy, physical symptoms or pain. In each case, optimism was a significant predictor of health outcomes or markers. And their final conclusion was that optimism is a significant predictor of positive physical health outcomes, that all things being equal, if you see an optimistic person, that person is going to be tend to be healthier than the pessimistic person experiencing generally the same circumstances. So, I mean, that's kind of the meta-analytic bottom line. It doesn't prove that that if you put on a happy face, you'll never get sick. But the link is there, and it's undeniable. And I was just, you know, impressed after thinking about out of 100, if there were 38 of these, if there's 4,500 of those, and you know, I know that this isn't scientific, but just to get a rough estimate of how many articles are out there that link optimism to positive health outcomes, you know, that puts us somewhere in the vicinity of, what, 1,300, 1,400, something like that. Different studies that have been done that make this connection. That is a substantial body of work that's going on. Now, you have to multiply the other one out. There were four, right? So 4 times 40, you know, there's 150 or so that show negative outcomes too. So you want to be aware of both of those. But again, it's about a 10-to-1 ratio of research showing positive health outcomes related to optimism over negative health outcomes. Definitely something we want to be aware of. Now, you said you had found an article too on this subject.
Yeah, it's another meta-analysis, and what's hilarious to me is that it appears to have been this is a meta-study on optimism written mm-hmm. by pessimists. You know,
no, there you go.
I swear, she must be a pessimist. Listen to this title: Optimism and Immunity. Do positive thoughts always lead to positive effects? And you can read the article, and the answer is no. They don't always lead to positive effects. You know, the key word there is always. You know,
right.
And of course, you know, very few things are in this world are always true. But you know, and you know, she even spends some time talking about you know, how there is a possibility of a negative effect of optimism on patients that are facing really, really difficult health situations. That at, you know, at some point the optimist reaches a breaking point, and they reach a situation where they're very disappointed. Their optimism didn't pan out, and the disappointment actually contributes to their decline. It appears. You know,
because how do we get to that place? Because they're terminally ill. They were previously optimistic that things were going to work out. Now they're not only terminally ill, but they're bitterly disappointed because things aren't going to work out.
Exactly.
Which is a terrible set of circumstances, obviously. I mean, that's horrible.
Yes. We don't want to make light of that. But my point is the person was terminally ill. You know, I mean, what did the optimism really hurt them? And most people, you know, in most health situations are not terminally ill. You know, I mean,
right.
And most health situations that you and I will face between now and our deaths, Phil, we will, all but the last one, we'll survive, right? So optimism will benefit us.
That's profound and yet true. Yes, you're right.
Yeah. Profoundly stupid or profoundly brilliant. You decide.
Good call, yeah.
And the optimism will help us every illness except the last one. So, you know, my point is,
right.
I hate to be pessimistic about this, but I'll probably be sick more than once between now and the time I die. So, you know.
Well, is it that, as Will says in the chat room, is it that once the disappointment occurs that the illness advances more rapidly than it did? That once they realize that they're
apparently so, yeah. According to what I'm reading here, apparently so.
Yeah. So, but it's really, of course, it's a matter of that they die sooner rather than, I mean, you know, the actual outcome doesn't change; it comes sooner. That's the. It's a terrible thing. I mean, it's bad. It's bad that people are disappointed, and it's bad that they die sooner. But the actual outcome hasn't really changed; it just happened more quickly.
And here's the thing: they lived their lives as optimists more than likely. You know, these people that were bitterly disappointed right at death, they still had a pretty good life otherwise. You know. Because they were optimists, and you know, so I'm just gonna take the chance that being an optimist is always the right thing to do, and that's the way I choose to live my life. So
I think so too. Well, I'm gonna if I were a betting man, I would bet on optimism. I would say it looks to me like it's the one that gets you closer to the positive outcomes, with a few caveats. The bottom line is it's not a substitute for doing things, right? Which is when we talk about the difference between the law of accelerating returns and the law of attraction, right? You can think about positive things, outcomes all you want to, but you have to do stuff, right? So it's like if you're optimistic that you're going to live a long time, but you continue to smoke, it just doesn't help, right? It might. An optimistic smoker might live longer than a pessimistic smoker, but it doesn't help as much as quitting smoking would have, right? And then being optimistic on top of quitting smoking. So these are all in the course of people receiving medical treatment. I guess that's my point. These studies are all about.
I'm sorry, Phil, I was just jumping in to say I think optimism leads to better decisions. I think an optimism is more likely to exercise. An optimist is more likely to exercise. Someone who, thinks life is pretty great is probably not the one that's going to be chain smoking,
Exactly.
I think the pessimist is more likely to make life decisions that are negative and that will tend to shorten their lives. So, anyway.
Absolutely. Well, now just before we leave this, and I think we've got a few examples of reasons to be optimistic. But before we get into that, I want to swing it back around just for a moment to those that second biggest category, which was the 27 stories that referred to the optimism of researchers or of the medical community generally. And I got to thinking if I had time. If I were working on a PhD right now, this would be a great research study to do, because what if you looked not just for the word optimism? You could also look for optimistic. You could look for hopeful. You could look for progress. But what if you went through these abstracts and looked for statements indicating generally that the medical community asserts that good outcomes are being achieved, that the good outcomes being sought are being achieved? I have no data on that, right? But my hunch is that it would go back to what you were saying earlier. It would be more than half, right? It would be, I think, the preponderance of those articles would show exactly that. If you think of optimism, as I do, as not just a positive disposition towards the future, not just a belief in a positive future, but the belief that there are positive outcomes to be had and the active seeking of positive outcomes. That's what I think. Like serious optimism really is. Medical research is a fundamentally optimistic activity, I think, when you look at it in those terms.
Absolutely. You got to think that what I'm doing will eventually amount to something at some point, or why bother, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, the practice of medicine is a fundamentally optimistic. Endeavor at that point. I mean, because generally you think you're going to provide beneficial outcomes to most of your patients most of the time. I hope most doctors think that anyway.
Yeah, that's right. Unless you're Dr. Kevorkian, right?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. Well, and even he would claim that was a beneficial outcome. So, it's all how you look at it.
An anecdotal story I think I've mentioned here in the last couple of weeks is Thomas Edison. Somebody said, "Well, gosh, you've failed 1,000 times trying to invent a light bulb." He says, "I have not. I've discovered 1,000 ways not to make a light bulb. I've been successful in that. I've eliminated 1,000 things. Now I can concentrate on the few remaining ways to make a light bulb." So
he assumed that there was a positive outcome to be had, and he was in pursuit of it. And the great thing about a story like Edison is that he was not discouraged ultimately by those 1,000 ways of how not to invent a light bulb, right? That his persistence in his belief that there was a positive outcome to be had was ultimately rewarded, and the whole world benefited from that in the long run. And I think it's true that most of what we talk about on this program, I mean, the actual fields that underlie, that provide the research that we talk about, you know, not just medical research, but all technological and scientific research has a strong optimistic bias to it. I think it has a strong assumption that there are positive outcomes to be had. And a lot of activities in life have that as well. So I think it's kind of reassuring. I note that Sally writes, optimism permits you to actively seek out positive outcomes, and so it's survival oriented. That's an excellent point. To an extent, we're all sort of the products of many generations of optimists deciding that you know, they could somehow hang in long enough to reproduce, right? That it was worth the effort to make that happen, and so in some sense, just being here reflects tremendous optimism of our remote and even our direct ancestors.
Well, I am descended from countless generations of men who managed to get lucky. So yeah, so that we should all be
optimistic. Exactly. Who didn't give up? Who thought maybe they could, right?
Yeah,
who found a thousand ways not to get
me,
laid,
yeah.
Right? And then,
that's hilarious.
Yeah, that's what it all falls down to. So anyway, with that in mind, and pardon my frivolousness there, but with that thought in mind, let's look at some of the reasons that. Why we might be optimistic about healthcare outcomes. What are these 27 out of 100 scientists? What are they talking about these days, Stephen? You got some examples for us?
I got three examples, and they're all absolutely just extremely cool.
Okay.
Here's the first one: immune system taught to recognize kidney transplants, freeing recipients from lifelong immunosuppressive drugs. That's huge. You know, I mean, if they can do it for kidneys, if they could do it for kidneys, maybe they can do it for a heart transplant.
The implication is any organ, ultimately, they could do it for, right? Yeah.
Exactly. And it's not, you're not having to weaken a person's immune system. The same immune system that fights off other illness, right, has to be weakened so that they don't reject the organ they've been given. And so they go through life in a weakened state and, you know, that's not any good way to live. You know, it's a frail way to live. And by just teaching the immune system to recognize, this kidney, it may have come from someone else, but it's now part of this body, immune system. So don't leave it alone. And
does the article go into what the mechanism is for that? How does it how does the immune system start to make that recognition around these kidneys, because it sounds like it's making an exception, right?
Right.
Because you're not just weakening the immune system. If you put some other foreign body in there, the immune system's still going to go crazy over that, right? But it's learning that this particular thing that's not part of this body is cool, and we'll treat it like it's part of the body. Yeah.
Okay, so here's the deal.
Okay.
Here's the mechanism, and it's pretty interesting. They kill the immune system altogether, and then they reintroduce, and then they build the immune system from scratch, recognizing
with that organ in there. Wow.
That's right. Yeah. So
basically, they take these people and they give them like bubble boy syndrome, right? They make them
exactly, and they
like,
and
it's like AIDS,
they
right? They have no yeah. They give them
an immune system transplant is what it amounts to after the transplant of the organ. So it's pretty neat. I'm going to put the link in the chat room for anybody who wants to check that out. So yeah, but kidney recipients freed from lifelong drugs. That was an article that came out on the 5th. So just a few days.
Yeah, I want to see that for sure. Did it say what's the length of time that course of treatment took? It sounds like a very intensive, long-term kind of a thing.
About 10 days after the transplant, Strober injects the patient with millions of white blood cells. Let's see. So far, 8 of his 12 trial patients have been free of immunosuppressive treatments for up to 3 years, although one died after 3 years from a heart attack unrelated to the treatment. You don't count that.
People who have had a kidney transplant are likely to have a number of health problems.
Yeah, you tend to have other health problems. Yeah, that's right. Anyway, it doesn't really say how long, there's a few days that they're just treated like, almost a regular transplant patient with immunosuppressive drugs, but then they go in and they radiate different parts of your immune system and kill it completely and then build it back up. It's fascinating,
That is really something. Well, because we've gotten so sophisticated at transplanting. There was a time when transplanting was this, lose-lose proposition. I mean, it's like we weren't very good at putting organs in that weren't there to begin with, and then the body wasn't very good at accepting them. And techniques for making it happen have gotten so sophisticated now that, we can really transplant a heart. I mean, we can put a heart in and have it, structurally in that person's body, the same as their original heart. The problem was that from that immunological standpoint, from the acceptance of it, you still had that issue, and you had this, ongoing long-term, people who've had transplants have to be constantly treated with these immune suppressant drugs, which I assume must have terrible side effects around making it easy for you to get other things. I mean, I don't know if that's true, but you would think that would be a big risk with immune suppressant drugs. And
well,
here with this study,
they catch everything, it's a rough way to have to live.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that so many people get kidney transplants these days. I mean, we've got terrific infrastructure to identify donors. People step up and they make the donations, which is really awesome. We're much better at matching than we used to be, and the techniques are much better than they used to be for actually performing the surgery. I mean, in every way, the process has gotten better. But this is the quantum leap. I mean, this is a big one. If you can actually get the body to accept it as though it were its own tissue, you're just one step away from, what I think is the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for organ transplant is to be able to, like, grow a cloned, your own kidney, right, and put it in there. That's ultimately what we want to see, take stem cells and print one out, right, like we talked about from that TED talk a few weeks ago. When we generate our body's own tissues, then you don't even have to reset your immune system. But this is pretty cool. This is, I'd say, the next best thing to that.
It's a bridge technology that gets us there. The people will be able to live with this kidney that's not their own as if it were. So that's pretty awesome. And the more we learn about our immune systems, the better. And so the very fact that they can kill somebody's immune system and then grow it back, or transplant it back, it's just remarkable.
That's astounding. Yeah.
Okay, next one.
If we were doing Astounding Science Facts, you could have listed that one.
Absolutely. Well, how about this one? Okay. Body suit may soon allow paralyzed to walk.
Oh, here's another Astounding Science Fact. Go.
Yeah,
what do you got?
Okay, so at Duke University, Dr. Miguel, I'm going to have trouble with his last name, Nicholas, I guess. I'm going to go with Miguel Nicholas, is merging brain science with engineering in a bid to create something fantastical, a full-body prosthetic device that will allow those immobilized by injury to walk again. So what he's doing is he's actually connecting this suit. Imagine an Iron Man suit. That's the way I'm picturing it. I'm sure it looks nothing like that, but that's the picture I got in my head. An Iron Man suit that's connected to someone's brain so that even though they're paralyzed, they're able to walk and to ambulate around by just thinking about walking the rest of us do, in some ways. So that is that's a big deal, and they're working towards that. So,
that's neat because there's we've tracked the progress of prosthetics being more and more responsive to neurological symbols, the signals that this really interesting interlinking that's going on between the human nervous system and robotic systems. $6 million man type stuff.
This is the same guy. This same guy, Phil, that did the thing where the monkey had like the wires in his head and was moving a robot arm.
Right.
You've probably heard of that. You know that deal. That's
we've
same,
talked about that
same.
Numerous times. One of my favorite stories. Yes.
This is the same team now is working on this full body suit that a paralyzed person can be put into and move around. So
anyone who said what's that whole thing about hooking monkey brains up to robot arms got to do with anything? Okay, now you know, people. See, that's why that was valuable research. It's leading to potentially people who couldn't walk being able to walk again, or people who are completely paralyzed being able to have mobility with their arms and legs. It doesn't get much better than that, does it?
No, it's extremely awesome. So. And in a way, Phil, of course, this is another bridging technology, right? I mean, the ultimate hope with, transplants is that we transplant our organs that are grown for us from our own stem cells or something. Well, the ultimate with a paralyzed person is to be able to basically reconnect them with their body and allow them to walk away and have the same mobility as they had before they were paralyzed. That's the ultimate. But in the meantime, this is another bridging technology that gets us there, maybe. So for people that are paralyzed, here's some reason to be optimistic. So
absolutely. Well, you know what it is? It's a hack, right? It's a workaround. Hacks can be elegant too. A workaround can be a beautiful thing if that's all that you can do at the time. I mean, we can imagine the solution being that nanotechnology goes in and repairs the damage to a nervous system and paralyzed limbs become active again. Or, to your point, you grow a cloned limb and you replace the damaged one, or you replace the damaged spinal tissue or whatever it is that needs to be replaced, and you restore a body to health that way. And ultimately, I think we'll get there. One day we will get there, but we're not there yet. So what can we do now? Oh, well, how about an entire exoskeleton suit that provides maybe not the exact same mobility, but, if it's even 60-70% of the same mobility, it's so much better than what you're going to get out of a wheelchair or something like that. It's hardly even worth thinking about. And if we're talking about full mobility, if we're talking about being able to move your hands, move your fingers, when before you couldn't, or when before that was very difficult, that's just huge. And as I'm thinking about this, when I hear about something like this, when I hear about paralysis, I always immediately think about victims of, accidents, people who've had trauma. That for some reason, that's the first thing that occurs to me. But this would be awfully beneficial to people with, myasthenia gravis, muscular dystrophy, cerebral palsy, right? I mean, any of these, any of these nervous system conditions that that cause that level of either complete paralysis or immobility potentially could be addressed by that. And it's a really wonderful story.
Souped-up heavy-duty versions of these suits could potentially help soldiers carry 500-pound loads while marching through the battlefield. Our potentially even emergency workers like a fireman be able to run through walls, things like that. So allow superhuman things to be done in suits for healthy people. So it's really exciting research.
Well, now I got to get one. Okay, so it's like
yeah.
I want to be able to perform the superhuman feats too. As soon as it becomes a consumer product, after it's available to everybody who really needs one, see about getting one. But actually, when you start talking about that, that kind of stuff, you can imagine the extreme sports possibilities of that sort of thing, you know. You know, what couldn't you do with a suit like that, right? Ultimately, you'll have, like, a Superman Olympics type stuff, people running up mountains and picking up boulders and throwing themselves to the bottom and who knows what. But that's a ways off. Meantime, and, of course, that's a bridge technology, too, until we get utility fog, right? And then we can all do those kinds of tricks. Okay, so what's the next one?
Okay, third and last of the exciting medical breakthroughs I've just read about. Keep in mind, this is just this week, okay? This is the ones you happen to skim off the top, right? Yeah. Okay, how about cure for diabetes in our brains? Neural stem cells extract, yeah. And they're not just thinking, you know, they're not just talking about some great idea someone has in someone's brain to cure diabetes. Cure for diabetes literally in our brains, neural stem cells extracted from rats by way of their nose. You know, pulled from their brain by way of their nose, turned into pancreatic cells to help grow a new pancreas or to aid a existing unhealthy pancreas. So exciting stuff there.
That's amazing. I mean, it's interesting that it comes from the brain. Could have come from anywhere. And it would have been great, right? But it's really interesting that that these neural stem cells somehow have the potential to become the correct pancreatic cells that are then going to be able to manufacture insulin. Is that that's the process you described?
Exactly. That is exactly it. And you know,
I mean, who would have thought of that, right? Who would have thought? Let's take these brain cells and turn them into pancreas cells, right? It's just.
Well, you know, this is what we were talking about earlier with, you know, ultimately what we want to do, instead of having transplants, we want to be able to grow our own organs, right? Well, here, the pancreas can't be transplanted for whatever reason. I'm not exactly sure why. You get the pancreas you're born with is the pancreas you die with, at least with our current technology. And so, you know, if you're born with an unhealthy one, or if for whatever reason your pancreas fails in life, then you're diabetic, and it's a growing problem, especially in the developed world, and so you know here is a way. This is not a hack, is it? This is a direct cure. If you can get the organ that was responsible for taking care of that problem up and operational again, that is that's not a hack. That's a cure. And so, yeah, this is that would be awesome if we can get that going. If they did it in rats, let's see, it's up for human trials. You know, anyone who might want to sign up for that. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, I'm going to add a few to the list, and I'm going to cheat as I did with PubMed. You know, the thing to do, Stephen, is to know where to look for information on the web. You know, it's like you can do a Google search and say, oh, what other health breakthroughs could we lose? But you know what I did? I went to instapundit.com and I did a search on two words. What words?
Optimism. Faster, please. Faster, please.
Faster, please. I just brought up the search page for faster, please on Instapundit. And I'm going to go back in time as far as about 3 months, and I'm not going to read all of them, okay? But I'm just going to read a few. All right. Sunburn pain discovery could lead to better arthritis treatments. Just exactly the principle we were talking about a minute ago. This amazing convergence of things being applied that you never would have expected. Harvard MIT team's new synthetic vocal cord gel gives voice to the voiceless. Superbug antibiotics, new drugs advanced amid R&D investment shortfall. Instant nano delivery vehicle for brain cancer therapy. Just add water. Mice. Oops, I lost. I scrolled at the same time I was reading. I shouldn't do that. Where'd it go? Mice. I've lost my place. Anyway, I'll just jump in with someplace else. Something interesting with mice, but let's see. Let me start with some other ones. Enzyme insights could lead to better sunburn treatment. Or did I already read that one?
No.
Yes.
Okay.
There we go.
Yeah.
Nanofiber regenerates blood vessels. Scientists discover possible genetic route to killing pain. a self-assembling microbot for drug delivery. Some of these are phrased as a question, you know, it's like a self-assembling microbot for drug delivery. Hey, sounds good to me. I mean, that's one of our that's one of our kind of core scenarios at the Speculus, isn't it? One of the things we talked about on our nanotechnology show, we talked about it.
We want an onboard doctor. You know, that's what we want. And sounds to me like that's not just an onboard doctor. That's an onboard, you know, medical lab, basically. Yeah, but sounds great.
Absolutely. Did I read the one, stem cells grow fully functional new teeth?
No, but
I didn't want to miss that
one. I read that one, and that's awesome. You know, if, you know, they've, about a year or so ago, I was reading that they were growing, you know, basically the roots, and then they would, you know, using stem cells, and then they would cap those roots. You know, the dentist could then cap them, and all you really need is a good root. And so they were, you know, they were installing the stem cells in people's gums. It would grow into a root, and then they'd cap it, and so they'd have a tooth that way. So that sounds like a fully functioning tooth. They got the whole thing this time now.
Yeah, absolutely. Growing teeth. I mean, and obviously in those instances, it's where a tooth was completely lost. But I've got a number of crowns in my head, and I always think someday, right? I used to think with nanotech, but now, you know, there's awfully interesting things going on with stem cells. I think one of these days I want to just grow these teeth back whole and sound. You know, I want the tooth there that looks as good as that crown does, right? And it actually be actually be my tooth, and we seem to be getting pretty close to that. I think you know, to swing this over to the automation putting us out of work, dentistry is one of the fields that that might first fall to nanotechnology and stem cell research. Actually, it won't, because it'll be dentists who will be applying those treatments, but the things that we typically think of dentists doing, you know, drilling holes in teeth and pulling teeth and doing root canals and all those kinds of things, it will be completely transformed with these restorative therapies of actually just putting teeth back to, you know, the way they should be. You'll have adults walking around with mouths full of completely fully formed, cavity-free, filling-free teeth. You know, it's a small thing, but really something to look forward to. Okay, there's so many of these. Protein switches could turn cancer cells into chemotherapy factories. Shark molecule kills human viruses too. Surgeons make cancer cells fluoresce for removal. Researchers announce a breakthrough on HIV/AIDS treatment. I'm not following the link, so I don't know what particular breakthrough it was. Tweaking our own genetic code. New implant can monitor tumors continuously. I mean, it's great because Glenn gets these and he just, you know, he pops them up, right? So you get... It seems like there's probably a faster please every day anyway, right? At least three or four a week.
Most people think of him as a political blogger. And yet, even this political blogger, if you want to call him that, he's actually much more than that. But, you know,
yeah.
I mean, he's able to come up with one a day. That's, you know, he's got to be missing some stuff, so... Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, well, and this is just doing Glenn. We're not even over on Brian Wong's site or, you know, any of the others where we could be pulling up a lot more of these. The thing is, we've kind of probably gotten used to seeing these kinds of things, but it really is remarkable when you bring up the list. I urge everyone listening to go to instapundit.com, go to, you know, scroll down, find the search bar, and just search on those words faster, please, and bring up the page that you get. It's really and by the way, they're not all medical health research related. A number of them have to do with energy technology and other cool things that are happening. But Glenn says that consistently about good news in medicine, and particularly. Interesting new therapies that show lots of promise, and when you see them all listed at once, you go, "Yes, I understand why the medical community is optimistic about a lot of the work they're doing." They're in spite of all the problems in the world, and in spite of all the difficulties that we face, whether economically or, you know, political turmoil or anything else, if you look at what's happening in the world, there is tremendous progress that's being made, and amazing things are happening. And you know, I think there's good reason to be optimistic about our health. That not only because that stands to make us healthier, but because that's a rational position to take with so many good things happening.
Absolutely.
Well,
Phil,
I think that
about does it, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I want to say one more thing about optimistic health outcomes, which is that Sonia Arison is going to be joining us. I'm not sure when. Might be 2 weeks from tonight. We're still scheduling it, but she's going to be talking about her new book, which is entitled, what's the name of that book, Stephen? You've got that, haven't you?
Oh goodness, it's on my phone here, of course. So I'm going to have trouble bringing
it. I know it's got 150.
Like 100 years or
100
plus.
150
or?
Plus, I believe it's called. Is that right? Or
I think it might be 100 plus. It's about,
excuse me.
Obviously, it's about long.
Sonia, I swear we'll know the name of the book by the time we have you on.
absolutely.
Here she plugged it on World Transformed. Anyway, the book is about the fact that our lifespan soon stands to be well over 100. I think she talks in terms of 150 year lifespan. Sonia, of course.
Here's the title. It's 100 plus, and how the coming age of longevity will change everything, from
exactly
careers and relationships to family, and I think the title goes on.
It will absolutely change everything, it's the direction we're headed in. So we can consider when we bring Sonia on to be a continuation of this discussion, and that should be, like I said, sometime in the next couple 3 weeks. Okay, so what's our music this evening?
Phil, I had to get to it. The song tonight is "The Roaring Season" by the Maudlin Hounds, of all things. So,
the Maudlin Hounds.
The Maudlin Hounds singing "The Roaring Season." So,
singing "The Roaring Season." All right, Stephen. Well, thanks for putting that together. Thanks for getting that great list of medical developments for us. And thank you all for listening to Fast Forward Radio. Thanks for being part of our show. We'll be back again next week with another exploration of accelerating change. We hope you'll be with us. And until next time, live to see it.